And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I feel privileged indeed to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with investigative reporter and best-selling author Craig Unger. His latest book is a really incredible look back at one of the most discussed and controversial moments in recent American history. The book is called Den of Spies, Reagan, Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason that Stole the White House. This book encircles the matter of what came to be known as the October Surprise, the possibility that then-Republican presidential candidate Ronald Reagan's campaign manager, William Casey, engaged in negotiations with the Iranians who were holding American hostages in the hopes that the hostages would not be released until after Election Day, in the hopes that that would further cripple the chances of incumbent President Jimmy Carter winning re-election. Well, we all know ultimately how that election turned out, and Ronald Reagan won a decisive victory. But the matter of whether or not all of this behind-the-scenes chicanery took place has been hotly debated over the years, and it has been a source of tremendous interest, to say the least, for my morning show guest, Craig Unger. For some 33 years, he has passionately researched this topic, explored it, and along the way has been fired at least once, sued, ostracized from much of Washington's Washington life, and so it has been at some cost that he has doggedly pursued the truth about what exactly happened with the October Surprise. All of this is chronicled in his new book, not just what he believes and believes he can demonstrate occurred in the so-called October Surprise, but also what this has been like for him in terms of a personal and professional odyssey. His previous books include House of Trump, House of Putin, also House of Bush, House of Saud, also Boss Rove, Inside Karl Rove's Secret Kingdom of Power, and several other books as well. Again, this latest one, published by HarperCollins, is Den of Spies, Reagan, Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason that Stole the White House. Craig Unger, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that I find interesting about your book, and your book is indeed interesting to say the least, is that, as I tried to indicate in the introduction, this book is as much about you and you as an investigative reporter as it is about the actual events which you have been researching and exploring. And I applaud that choice. I mean, I think it's part of what makes the book so compelling. Was that your intention right from the start? And what was behind that decision for you to take readers into, in a sense, your own personal and professional experience over the past 33 years?
Right. Well, it was a very deliberate decision, and it's the only personal book I've written. I've written, I think, a total of 8 books, and this is the first time I've ever really referred to myself. In fact, one of the first lessons I learned in journalism is don't make it about yourself. But this time I thought it was worth making an exception, because I think a lot of readers don't realize where the news comes from, what a reporter goes through in order to get to the truth. And often reporters, I think, are really damaged and crippled by what I call access journalism. That is, they want to be close to the big power brokers, whether it would have been a Henry Kissinger during this era. And I think in once you get too close to those sources of power, you're essentially carrying water for them, and you're not getting to the real truth. So I stayed away from the big name, big power brokers as sources, and I did a research on and off for over 30 years, as you say. I went back to it again and again. I started out doing a big story for Esquire magazine in 1991 that got huge response, enormous response, and Newsweek hired me right after that, presumably to finish the investigation. But while I was at Newsweek, things suddenly switched, and it was as if every reporter I know got enormous pushback, and you couldn't pursue this investigation. If you did, you would be you became toxic. You were called a conspiracy nut, one of those tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy nuts. But I kept at it, and I believe, I mean, it took me a long time, but I came up with new evidence, with documentary evidence that showed there were, in fact, arms sales from Republican operatives to Iran during the 1980 election, and that, in fact, an act of treason, this was a treasonous covert operation that took place, and I think I finally came up with evidence to prove it.
Hmm. I want to just circle back to some of these matters of what it is like to be a journalist, because and it's clearly important to you because you spend some time talking about this, and you really help us kind of understand how something that we call conventional wisdom can spring up around certain issues. And again, as you say, so much of it has to do with the fact that access is so important. And you say at one point, our sources often play a greater role in what we actually write. That is greater than maybe what our editors are asking for. And I'd never stopped to think about that, but that really is true. I mean, if you have the sizzle of an exclusive from some towering figure in the government, that will be, in a sense, by its very nature, an important story that will be greatly noticed. And I think what you're pointing to is that it is a lonelier and more difficult road when one seeks to be an investigative reporter without that sense of currying favor from big name sources. I appreciate the way you help us as readers, as consumers of the news, to understand this.
Well, thank you. And it's enormously relevant today, of course. And I think we see it with Donald Trump. People sometimes are saying that Trump says all these wild, crazy things, but it's normalized by the press. And one reason for that is if you want to get close to Donald Trump, you have to be reasonably nice to him, or you'll never have access again. And that's clear even for the powerful television networks or the loneliest freelance reporter. So the people who end up getting a certain visibility, a certain fame, and money out of it are people who end up carrying water for the big power brokers like Trump, or I'm going back to the Reagan era, where Kissinger played such a role, and of course a lot of people who were part of the Reagan campaign.
And of course, to be fair, and to be even-handed about this, what you are talking about is something that does not simply occur on one side of the political aisle. And most politicians, at least, are human beings, as are reporters. And so between Republican officials and reporters, between Democrat officials and reporters and so on, I'm sure this kind of thing goes on all the time. And it is important for us all to understand the role that it plays in terms of what gets written about whom.
Absolutely. I never saw it more clearly than going through the October surprise. I mean, this took place during a period when the media landscape was so different than it is today. And I was at Newsweek magazine for some of the times. I don't know if young people today realize how powerful institutions like Newsweek and Time Magazine back then were in determining the national conversation. And what I went through, I could see it suddenly become distorted because people were not really going after the truth.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with investigative reporter Craig Unger about his latest book, which is called Den of Spies, Reagan, Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason That Stole the White House. This is a story that he has been doggedly pursuing for some 33 years concerning the so-called October Surprise, the possibility that insiders in the Reagan presidential campaign reached out to officials in Iran in the hopes of prolonging the hostage crisis, and an exchange of arms was promised to the Iranians. And Craig Unger and others, of course, over the years have been investigating this story, which at certain times has been widely embraced and at other points offhandedly dismissed as nothing but a hoax, an outlandish conspiracy theory. Mr. Unger, before we dig into some specifics about what occurred in 1980 and thereafter, I want to just ask you about something you say very early in the book. In talking about this so-called October Surprise, which you began earnestly investigating back in 1991, you write, "It became the background noise to my life as a journalist, something between a hobby and a part-time obsession." I'm so intrigued by that turn of phrase, especially the last part, because I've never heard nor even imagined such a thing as a part-time obsession. I think most of the time when we think of obsessions, we think of them as utterly consuming our entire life and in all of our time and all of our resources and so on. And, of course, you're talking about what you yourself call an obsession, but that apparently you tried to sort of keep at bay so you could continue to function in other arenas. But could you just say a word about this, your odd relationship over the years with this particular story?
Sure. Well, I did pursue it for 33 years, but in truth, it was on and off, and I simply didn't have the luxury in financial terms of spending all my time on this. I had to make a living. And so I went to Boston for 5 years, where I ran a magazine. I also wrote 7 other books during this period. But I did go back to it from time to time. It was never completely out of my mind. And I think it shaped my career in a lot of ways, in that I could see the reality. We were just speaking of it earlier, that who your sources are and your relationships to them are very, very important. And I often found the best sources of all were people who are not particularly famous. I mean, if you followed the whole Trump-Russia scandal, you remember a woman like Cassidy Hutchinson came out of the blue. And she was sort of a lower middle-level person who was there. She was present. But she wasn't a big name. She wasn't a bit powerful figure. And I sort of went for sources like that, for people who were very knowledgeable, but they were not the main actors. And it became, you know, if you want to do serious investigative reporting, you have to know what is the agenda of the sources you're talking to. And you have to consistently corroborate or refute people. You have to talk to people who may be dubious characters. I mean, whether it's a lot of this had to do with arms dealing with the October Surprise. Proving it, you had to prove that illegal shipments of arms took place and went to Iran and had been originated from the figures tied to the Republican campaign. And that's what I've been doing for all this time. And it took a while, but I think I finally got clear documentary evidence that the October Surprise actually did take place. And the book, I actually print the receipts showing that one of Bill Casey was the campaign manager for Ronald Reagan. He was also one of the great master spies, and he's a hugely important figure in the book, and that he had orchestrated this very elaborate covert operation during the presidential campaign that no one knew about.
We should not take long with this, but for the sake of any younger listeners particularly who were not around back in 1979 and 1980, I think it would be helpful for us to very, very briefly summarize the most central events, beginning with, of course, America's relationship with the Shah of Iran as he was about to topple from power in Iran, and of course ultimately then the taking of American hostages in November of 1979 and so on. Just briefly summarize this particular situation before we explore this matter of the so-called October surprise.
Right. Well, the Shah of Iran had been installed as the ruler of Iran in 1953 by a CIA coup. And in many ways, this was considered one of the most successful operations the CIA ever accomplished. I think the cost to the United States were under $20 million. And we ended up getting control over an oil-rich country, could supply oil to the entire Western world for the next generation out of it. And it was, and Iran was also a huge power broker and a powerful force in the Middle East. But the Shah was enormously brutal and repressive. He was overthrown in the Islamic Revolution of 1979, and suddenly the geopolitical playing field was a mess for the United States. And this is when the hostage crisis took place, and Iran seized 52 American hostages. And this was just as the 1980 presidential election was getting underway. And the entire outcome of the election depended upon whether or not Jimmy Carter would get the hostages home in time before the election, in which case he'd probably be revered as a hero. But in fact, the hostages didn't come home, and Carter was humiliated, was seen as a weak president who allowed America to be humiliated by Iran, and as a result, Reagan won the presidency.
One of the things I appreciate you taking the time to discuss is the attempted rescue mission, Operation Eagle Cloud, I believe, that was, I think in your words, an enormously complicated and dangerous mission. And it is a rescue mission that ends disastrously. And I had never read this before, that in the wake of that rescue mission, it became impossible to attempt a second mission, because you tell us after that, the American hostages were scattered to multiple locations. So there was no possibility of some helicopter dropping down into, you know, this compound and scooping up the hostages and spiriting them away. I mean, that became an impossibility because of the failure of that attempted rescue mission. And I'd never heard before that stated so clearly, that was a cost to that rescue mission failure that most of us were not even particularly aware of.
Right. It was a brutal blow to President Carter, and in a lot of ways people thought that that's when the election, his prospects for re-election ended. This was in April of the year of 1980, April 24th. Eight Americans were killed in the rescue attempt, and it was a disaster within Iran. You know, Americans now had military forces in Iran, so domestically in Iran, no politician could get away with saying, oh, we've got to negotiate with the Americans. So diplomatic channels were basically shut down at that point. And in some ways, that gave Bill Casey and the Republican Party a real opening in which they could begin to secretly have these back-channel negotiations with Iran that took place in secret meetings in Madrid and in Paris. And they were essentially doing an operation that was treasonous, I believe. They were aiding a hostile foreign power. I mean, for some of your younger listeners, I mean, I think they may not be aware, but at the time, Iranians were marching in the streets chanting death to America. They called America the Great Satan. And during the presidential campaign, the Republicans would always joke about how Reagan would bomb Iran to smithereens. And in fact, exactly the opposite was taking place. Secretly, Iran was sending weapons to the Republicans were sending weapons to Iran, and that's because they wanted Iran to be able to fight Iraq, which was the Iran-Iraq war, which is starting at the same time.
Hmm. Maybe you're touching on the answer to my next question. When you are talking about the failure of that rescue mission attempt, a rescue mission that was perhaps so ill-conceived that Secretary of State Cyrus Vance resigned in essentially protest over it. I mean, we've already touched on what happened then to the hostages being scattered to multiple locations. And then you write, you know, with no new rescue mission possible at that point, you write, for all practical purposes, the election was over. That is, you're referring to the re-election hopes of President Carter were, for all practical purposes, over with that terrible failure. My question was going to be, then why would it make sense for anybody connected with Ronald Reagan's election bid to engage in this if the victory of Ronald Reagan, because of this terrible failure, was already pretty much a foregone conclusion?
Well, it was not entirely clear, and publicly no one knew whether or not the hostages would come back or not. The Carter administration was unaware of all the secret meetings taking place between the Republicans and Iran. So they were frankly a little confused, and they kept hoping. The Iranian government was a mess at the time. It was just coming out of a revolution, and so various factions were jockeying for stability, and they hoped Carter hoped the more moderates would prevail, and then they could reach a deal and return home the hostages. But what was secretly going on in terms of Casey's operation made that impossible. And there were several times at which the Carter administration would reach out to try with a peace overture. They reached out through Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. But Bill Casey, the chairman of the Reagan campaign, found out about it. He had intelligence operatives who intervened and thwarted that outreach. He did that with the Palestinians, and he managed to keep Carter from bringing home the hostages.
Hmm. I want to ask you at this point about something you spent some time talking about. I want to make sure that I understand the connection, and this is also something I really learned from your book. I don't remember ever knowing much about this, and this is the very sour relationship between the CIA and the Carter administration, particularly after President Carter installed Stansfield Turner as the new CIA director, who then engaged in some house cleaning. And you kind of outlined some of the reasons why such house cleaning was probably very much necessary. But you talk about, or actually you quote somebody talking about, the profoundly demoralized military and intelligence communities. Tell us more about this state of affairs and why it, I guess what I'm really getting at is why it matters or how it matters in terms of how these events that we call the October Surprise unfolded.
Right. Well, a very sour relationship is understating it. It was real. They hated him. I mean, it was as simple as that. And it's worth going back to look at the CIA in the period between World War II, ending in 1945, and in 1976, when the Carter administration took place. And the CIA had been doing one coup d'etat after another in the post-war era. They overthrew the Shah. They installed the Shah of Iran in 1953. That was a CIA coup d'etat. They did it in Guatemala in 1954. They did one in Syria, I believe it was 1949. The Dominican Republic, Vietnam, the CIA was doing coup d'etats all over the world. They were running their own foreign policy, and they were assassinating world leaders. But by the mid-70s, suddenly that was exposed, and for the first time there was real accountability and oversight. There was Senator Frank Church put together the Church Committee, and they investigated the CIA, and they uncovered a lot of the extracurricular activity I just outlined. So suddenly the CIA was weakened. Jimmy Carter is elected in 1976, and he puts in charge of the CIA Stansfield Turner, his old buddy from the United States Naval Academy. And Stansfield Turner fired 800 operatives from the directorate, the operations directorate of the CIA. And that meant you had hundreds and hundreds of really bitter, angry CIA operatives who were running around loose looking for something to do. And some of them were friendly with Bill Casey and the Republican campaign. So this is in a big way how the opposition to Jimmy Carter was able to put together covert operations. I believe they were treasonous covert operations to aid a hostile foreign power. I mean, you know, the unlikeliness of this, you know, the Republicans have always been the more militaristic of the two major parties here. They were so in the Cold War era, in Vietnam, and when it came to Iran. And yet, here they are, secretly embracing the militant Islamists who led, these are the extremists who led the Iranian revolution, and they're making a secret deal where the Republicans are sending them weapons.
So it is your contention that there were disgruntled members of the CIA, or maybe former employees of the CIA, who are actually direct participants in the so-called October Surprise.
Right. And Casey had, Bill Casey was a wonderful, wonderful figure, I think. He was dazzlingly brilliant, but he was a complete slob. I compare him to, he's sort of like a mixture of James Bond and Mr. Magoo. He mumbled, and no one could understand what the hell he was saying. He would be talking in speedy bursts, spitting out of his mouth all the time, going in half a dozen directions at once. But he was also quite brilliant, and he was capable of doing six or seven things that seemed completely unrelated, that where no one, people had knowledge only on a need-to-know basis. So no one knew everything that was going on. And what I was able to put together in this book was that even before he became campaign manager for Ronald Reagan, he had a secret network, and he knew arms dealers all over the world who would sell arms, to illegal arms sales to South Africa. He was in touch regularly with Israeli military intelligence, and I talked to the head of Israeli military intelligence, Yehoshua Segee, who said Casey and he were talking together in 1979 and 1980, and Casey was not in the United States government. He had no intelligence clearance at that point. But Casey was on top of all that, and he was headed towards becoming campaign manager for Ronald Reagan. And when he got that position, he had all the elements in place to put together a rather sophisticated and elaborate covert operation.
We are speaking with Craig Unger about his newest book, Den of Spies, Reagan, Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason That Stole the White House. This looks at the so-called October Surprise, and this is a story which Craig Unger has been following and investigating for more than three decades. Mr. Unger, have we yet touched on this odd name, October Surprise, and why this particular conspiracy is called the October Surprise?
Right. Well, the phrase originated, the phrase really means an explosive bombshell that completely derails the presidential election. obviously the election's in early November, so if something explosive happens in October, that may change everything. And it was originated by the Republicans referring to the possibility that Carter would bring home the American hostages from Iran in October, just before the election. And they presumed he would try to do that. And they were saying his timing was manipulative, because he would then be greeted by a burst of patriotic fervor, and presumably that would help him win the election. But the meaning was turned on its head, because the Republicans secretly had this covert operation going. And that, to me, is what the October surprise means today. It's October before an election. And the reason this book is out now, because in many ways I see it as a prequel. And I think the Republicans have done this repeatedly, and I refer to it in my book, that in 1968 they did something similar when Nixon was running against Humphrey. Lyndon Johnson was trying to end the Vietnam War with the Paris peace talks, and secretly Nixon had an operative intervene and he got the South Vietnamese to pull out of the Paris peace talks, and suddenly the Democrats had egg on their face because they were unable to even to put together, get their own allies to attend the peace conference. So it happened in 1968. I show that it happened. When it happened in 68, by the way, Nixon, who won the election, obviously, was so concerned that the Democrats had documents, they had a smoking gun about his intervention in 68, and as a result, he put together a team of burglars who broke into various places in Washington, including a hotel residential complex known as the Watergate. So again, you had that was the birth of the Watergate scandal in 72. You have the October surprise in my book in 1980. In 2016, you have Trump allying with Russia, and he does it overtly. He does it quite openly. He said, "Russia, if you can hear me, leak out those emails, because they had hacked the Democrats." And a lot of what I'm talking about, and I think is so disturbing, is you have the Republican Party, which is out of power, but in effect they are hijacking American foreign policy and using it for their own partisan ends. Hmm.
So this matter of the October surprise, this possibility of people connected with Ronald Reagan's election campaign doing this behind the scenes to prolong the hostage crisis and also to secure an arms deal, which in a sense violated the embargo against Iran in place at that time. Were there serious suspicions of something sinister afoot, or was it only with the publication of this article in 1991 in the New York Times that this possibility was seriously raised?
Right. You know, it's very interesting because Ronald Reagan was inaugurated in January 20th, 1981, and the hostages were released as he was still on the podium. So it was literally within minutes of him being sworn in as president. So we know for a fact, this was nakedly obvious to all Americans, that Reagan could not have negotiated with them while he was president, because he'd only been president for a few minutes, and he was on the podium. And yet they didn't return them to Jimmy Carter. So it certainly raised suspicions. And the Onion, this satirical magazine, did a book on the 20th century, and for this day in history, they said, "Reagan inaugurated tells America not to put two and two together." So it seemed very obvious on the face if you just followed things, but it really only leaked out gradually. And President Bonnie Sadr, who was the former president of Iran, did speak out about it. He said that it happened, and he gave interviews to both the New York Times and to the Miami Herald saying it happened. He gave documents to Congress and to me, by the way. So there was evidence out there that it happened, but it came out in bits and pieces until 1991, when Gary Sick, who was a member of the National Security Council, wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times that took it quite seriously and put together a scenario that made sense for the first time. And that's how I started to get involved in the investigation. Once that happened, I knew there was a serious possibility that all of this had taken place.
Right. And one of the most interesting things you then chronicle in your book is how this article is published. There are other follow-ups, including your explosive article for Esquire magazine, the result of some 150 different interviews which you conducted. And this is, for a time, an enormous story. And then at some point, this story becomes utterly discredited. And we've already sort of touched on it in an ancillary way, but I want you to just talk for a few moments about the way in which the nature of this story and the way it was widely perceived and received, how that changed so drastically.
Right. Well, once that story came out in the New York Times, suddenly it's worth remembering this was an election. We were heading towards another presidential election in 1992, and George H.W. Bush was president. And since he was allegedly involved in the October surprise, this became potentially the most explosive story since Watergate. And as any reporter who was on it sort of realized, wow, this is the kind of story that can make or break your career. My story in Esquire was received very well, and then I was hired by Newsweek, but suddenly things took a 180. Everything went into reverse. It was as if everything that was reported became unreported. And in order to do this kind of story, you had to talk to arms dealers, and arms dealers do not have the greatest reputations in the world. But it's like investigating any crime. You suddenly become aware that the people who know most about crimes are criminals, the people who participate in them. The same year that I was investigating this, John Gotti, who was the big mobster of the time, he was on trial, and there was only one witness against him, Sal Gravano. Sal Gravano had killed 17 people. Hardly a sterling character, and yet his testimony helped convict John Gotti because you could corroborate or refute it, and people could corroborate enough of it that John Gotti was convicted. And that's what I was trying to do with this, was to corroborate or refute the material we were getting from arms dealers. But again and again, I was attacked for even interviewing these arms dealers. I mean, people would say, well, you'd have to be gullible to believe anything they tell you. And to me, it wasn't a question of believing them. I was trying to corroborate or refute their story.
Right. If I can just jump in for a second. In as you describe the work that you did, and particularly in speaking with one Ari Ben Menashe, a freelance arms dealer, a rogue Israeli operative, and someone you describe as a problematic source of information, to say the least, you talk about how you had three options for how you could use him. You could just not use him at all, not listen to anything he had to say, or you could cite him in only a very limited way for background information, or you could cite him as a knowledgeable but flawed source. And of course, part of what you have to weigh as a reporter is, if I am basing this report and these assumptions or allegations or conclusions, if I'm basing that in large measure on someone who is not fully trustworthy, then I put the whole undertaking at serious risk. And I think a lot of us don't stop to think about those kind of calculations that a reporter must engage in.
Right, and that it's often true that some of these dubious sources have access to really sensitive information, and you try to document that and corroborate it. And what I was able to do, and it took years, but I did end up getting the receipts, as it were, actual invoices of arms that were sold from Republican political operatives to Iran during the October Prize. And those I have those documents, and they're published in the book, and I believe they prove that the October Prize did take place.
I think one of the really interesting moments is when you talk about all of the various potential participants in this began reaching out. You write at one point, suddenly my Rolodex was filled with renegade Israeli operatives, South African arms dealers, arms procurement officials, Israeli generals, and the like. Before the October surprise, I had never even spoken to an arms dealer. Now there were operatives from five continents offering their stories to me, each one more disreputable than the next. Who were these guys? I mean, it's so interesting to think about the world into which you were plunged. And, of course, it's as you're describing this that you raise the unsettling specter of disinformation, that some of these people were reaching out to you specifically to share disinformation, wrong information, that would, in a sense, undermine your efforts, or at least that was certainly one possibility.
Absolutely, and the truth of the matter is they were coming from all sorts of different directions, and they had very different agendas. They were not all giving disinformation for the same reason. This Ari Ben Menashe, for example, you mentioned, and he was a freelance, sort of a rogue Israeli operative. And he had been busted for arms dealing and was held in Metropolitan Correctional Center here in New York, the same place where Jeffrey Epstein died. But the Israelis sort of let him twist in the wind. The Israelis had been secretly, they wanted Iran to be armed. They hated Jimmy Carter. And when Jimmy Carter imposed an arms embargo against Iran, Israel was angry. They were scared that Saddam Hussein was just about to invade Iran. Saddam Hussein's Iraq was just about to invade Iran, and the Iran-Iraq war was just getting started. And if Saddam had prevailed and had beaten Iran, suddenly you'd have a superpower who would be run by Saddam Hussein. That would be very, very dangerous indeed. So Israel wanted the weapons to go. They also wanted to discredit Ben Menashe, who had been sort of rogue. So I was hearing from suddenly being attacked from people who were getting disinformation from Israel. And that kind of thing went on. And it made it really impossible to do a serious investigation, because you were always sort of fending off critics and attacks from sources that were very hard to unravel. Mm.
Well, your book, of course, goes on to chronicle more of your efforts over the years to uncover still more information about this. We just have a couple of minutes left, but and we leave it, of course, to our listeners to explore your book in its entirety, to learn everything. But what would be kind of the general nature of the more recent information that you have been able to uncover? Not even all of the specifics, but just kind of the nature of where you were able to turn to finally get some important questions answered at last.
Right. I wasn't the only person investigating this, and there was a wonderful reporter named Bob Perry. He died a few years ago, I think in 2018. And Bob Perry was sort of my rival because we were on the same story. We were competing which of us was going to break this first. And, you know, the longer you got on the October Surprise, the more it seemed like whoever won would get a booby prize. I got sued and fired. And Bob essentially was working at home. He ended up doing his own website and blogging about it for years. I have to give him credit. He got farther along the trail of reporting on this than I did. After he died, his wife shared his archives with me. And I had a big advantage over Bob in that they were finally digitized in the last few years, which meant I could search through literally millions of pages of documents, and I could now finally search through it electronically. And when I did that, I found documents that had never really been seen the light of day. What was one of the most astonishing things going on was Congress was supposedly investigating the October Surprise. And I believe the investigation was a complete whitewash, and so did Bob Perry. But Bob actually went into an abandoned storage room in the bowels of Congress, where he saw cardboard boxes full of documents that the congressional investigation was basically abandoning. And he got those documents. And when he died, I got them. And it's just extraordinary, the information that Congress actually had, that is the documents that I show in my book, that are reprinted in my book. Congress had them. And if they had bothered to look at them, I think they would have set this matter to rest many, many years ago.
Hmm. Well, at one point you say in the book, if indeed this is true, I mean, it's not and if, as far as you're concerned, but let's say if all of this is true, if this October Surprise unfolded as you describe, this was treachery on an epic scale. And you go on to say in your book, if we are to survive as a democracy, it's vital to understand what happened those many years ago. The book again is Den of Spies, Reagan, Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason That Stole the White House, published by HarperCollins. The author, Craig Unger. Craig Unger, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your book.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will spend part of the time previewing the next production of The Lakeside Players of Kenosha, the musical Young Frankenstein by Mel Brooks, to be performed at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear pays his monthly visit to the program, offering his commentary on various current events and issues. And on Friday, the first of a two-part interview I was able to record with composer Ricky Ian Gordon, based on his amazing new memoir called Seeing Through, a memoir of sex, love, and opera. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you, you can also hear The Morning Show as a podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. We have increasing clouds in our forecast for today. We're headed for a high of 70 degrees. And there is a chance, about a 20% chance, of some showers developing before the end of the afternoon. A chance of some scattered showers as well over this evening. Tomorrow, a little bit cooler than today. We're approaching 9 o'clock. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.